Are you paralyzed by knowing too much?
I make a mental health argument for facing reality.
The world's problems are big, but they're not insurmountable. A roadmap for change. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Climate change has become far less debatable since Hurricane Sandy hit the Northeast, and multiple giant storms and tornadoes in the Midwest this year just put the exclamation point on what scientists have been saying for a long time. The weather is becoming more extreme, and it's time to take action to reduce our own impact on the climate. Author Mary Pfeiffer's new book, The Green Boat, takes the same clear-eyed approach to dealing with the world's problems that her previous bestseller, Reviving Ophelia, used to highlight the issues faced by today's girls and young women. Pfeiffer got involved in the fight against the Keystone Oil Pipeline route, which has since been rerouted. What she learned as an activist are lessons she thinks are important for all of us to remember with every issue, from an economic meltdown to the survival of the planet. Mary, in your book, Reviving Ophelia, you really put a name to a problem that we all sensed existed, but we really didn't know how to get our arms around when it dealt with young women and girls. When you began this book, The Green Boat, were you looking for a similar kind of an issue, or did it simply happen as a result of your activism against the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, you know, I appreciate your tying this book to Reviving Ophelia, because really the same process was occurring in me when I wrote Reviving Ophelia. I wrote it because as a therapist and as a mother, a lot of things were happening with teenage girls that I didn't understand, and also that I didn't feel like the information in the culture was very helpful. It seemed like there was a big disconnect between sort of the information I could pick up reading and talking to people and so on from what I really needed to know. And it even seemed like there were some things wrong with the information. And so I wanted to think through for myself, what is happening here? And why isn't, you know, why aren't things making sense the way they should? And why isn't common sense, you know, why isn't common sense sensible at this point with teenage girls? And that's kind of where I felt I was 3 years ago with this issue around global climate change. My own experience of living in Nebraska, which has always had very changeable weather, is that our weather is really changing. 3 years ago, we had very serious flooding. 2 years ago, we had very serious flooding. Last year, we had a terrible drought, and trees died, the fields dried up. The Platte River went totally dry last year. Yeah. All the fish in the river died. This year, we're having flooding again. So it's been very strange weather. And then in that summer of 2010, I read Bill McKibben's Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, in which he presents all the scientific information and its implications. And a really a rather alarming conclusion that we don't have 50 years to get our act together and behave in an adaptive manner to have a sustainable future. We have 10. When I first finished that book, Susan, I just was in despair. I just walked around the house 3 days just kind of stunned by it, you know. And I've got little grandchildren. I've got children. I just was so emotionally hit by this information. And then I realized, even more dispiriting, I didn't know how to talk about this with anyone. Not my own adult children, not my closest friends. And that's kind of when I started getting curious and started really thinking, you know, there's an unexplored terrain around this issue. There is such a disconnect between the scientific knowledge and the urgency of these issues and our ability as individuals and as a culture to talk about these issues and to organize ourselves to respond in adaptive measure. I mean, just for example, compare our response to 9/11 to our response to this alarming information about global climate change. And one of the reasons we can respond to, for example, tornadoes or fires or floods or even terrorism, sadly, by now, is we've seen it happen before. And it's a discrete event, and we have the tools to respond to it, and we know how to talk about it to each other, and there's kind of protocols and a history of responding. And none of that really applies with global climate change. But there's also another reason, and that is trauma, that this information, in the absence of actionable intelligence, is just overwhelming. If we don't know how to respond to it, it just becomes internalized, and sometimes it's as depression or anger or feelings of impotency. But the ways that we, at this point, respond to it isolate us from each other often and just keep us from acting with a sense of agency and hope.
And psychologically, as humans, we do tend to deny what we feel powerless to change.
Absolutely. It's totally understandable. You know, I tried to write this book with the tone I always try to write my books, a therapist tone. And, you know, therapists know all about denial and resistance. These are human qualities. And you know, it really, as both a mother and a therapist, one of the things I know about humans who are not behaving in the most adaptive of all possible ways is shouting, wake up, doesn't work, you know, and scolding people for not being awake doesn't work. Really what has to happen is helping people understand that awareness is bearable, that understanding and accepting reality is not only bearable, but eventually leads to a better place. So this book is actually about mental health, individual and cultural, and I make a mental health argument for activism. Because what I say is the mind functions best when it acts as if there is hope. And that when you succeed in facing a problem and mobilizing yourself to act, and especially finding other people to be with as you form a community of people engaged in action, you start to feel better, and you start to feel more powerful and some sense of agency. And that has all kinds of effects on one's life, including more vibrancy and more joy. So I make a mental health argument for facing reality.
And that sounds good theoretically, but in practice can be difficult. But you did put it into practice. So what did you find as you got involved in activism against the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, you know, I started the way I really think is best, frankly, and that is with a few people coming over to my living room. And we got together to talk about the Keystone XL pipeline TransCanada wants to build from Alberta down to Texas. And I don't know if most of your listeners are up on this issue, Susan, but right now, if it's built, it's scheduled to go right through Nebraska and over our Ogallala Aquifer that supplies fresh water to about 30% of the country. And I didn't want that pipeline coming through my state. I don't want it befouling our water. I know the fragile Sand Hills area that covers the aquifer out in the territory it's slated to cross. So I just invited a few friends over, and there should be a word between meeting and party, like peeting, because I know my friends are busy. I know they have enough on their plates without taking on fighting the fossil fuel industry in our state. We always have potlucks, and we have them in people's houses, and we have them in parks when we can in the summer. And we always plan actions. And our little group, it's been going for 3 years now. And it's not just our little group. What really happened is our group encouraged other people to organize groups, and they encouraged other people. It's been a really viral kind of situation in Nebraska. And our state, which has historically been a very conservative state, at least for the last 50 years, has really become energized around these issues. So by now we're a well-educated state on energy issues and especially the pipeline issues. We have a lot of community action in this state. You know, one more thing I would like to say about this, Susan, is this particular issue we have been very successful at framing in non-ideological terms. It's not a Republican or a Democrat issue. In fact, I'm an urban person. Most of my friends are in the academic community and urban professionals. One of the biggest surprises to us is our first allies were ranchers and farmers. And our icon is a Republican rancher named Randy Thompson that looks like John Wayne. So we have him. We have pictures of him on a lot of our brochures and information that's out all over the country. But at one point, Randy stood up at a rally and he said, "There's no red water or blue water. There's clean water and dirty water." And that's really how we've been able to talk about these issues, which I regard as a great victory. Because as soon as things are couched in ideological terms in this country, they're almost bound to get screwed up one way or another.
Mary Pfeiffer is the author of The Green Boat, Reviving Ourselves in Our Capsized Culture. Coming up, we'll have more with Mary Pfeiffer and a profile of one woman who challenged an entire society. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1249. It's a complicated world, and the tangle of issues we face can seem insurmountable. A generation of young graduates with crushing student debt, seniors who can't afford to retire, food that isn't nutritious and isn't even safe, plus a world's worth of social and economic issues eclipsed by the frightening acceleration of severe weather outbreaks. It's not an easy reality to face. But author Mary Pfeiffer, best known for her groundbreaking book on young women called Reviving Ophelia, believes we must have hope and we must act. At some point, you have to get the politicians involved, which immediately throws you back into the partisanship. How do you handle that?
Well, we had a lot of fun with our politicians. I mean, one of the very interesting dynamics of this in Nebraska, our legislator is theoretically nonpartisan. It's a unicameral. It's unlike most other state legislatures. But TransCanada had heavily lobbied our governor, our attorney general, and the legislators. And they had no plans to interfere in any way with TransCanada's actions through our state. And furthermore, we had no laws on the books to stop a pipeline from coming through the Sandhills. But the people got upset. And the people started pummeling these politicians to write some laws and do some investigating. And for the most part, they wouldn't do it. We had one or two legislators who'd work with us. But we had all kinds of citizens' campaigns to basically embarrass our politicians. For example, I formed a group called the Apple Pie Brigade. And it was a bunch of grandmas like myself. And we went up to the governor's mansion every Monday. And it was called a thank you and advance campaign. We took presents. We took homemade muffins and wildflowers and pies, little, whatever we had that was a little present to the governor, little paintings and little gift cards and so on, with letters thanking him in advance for protecting our state's water. The guard came out and in a very perfunctory manner took all our presents. But we just kept that up, and we persisted in asking for a meeting with our governor, and we finally got one. And we don't know if our just continually calling press conferences and bugging the governor had any effect, but about a week after our meeting, our governor called a special session to deal with this pipeline. We are civil people. We're very well-behaved people. We're modest. That's why a lot of our actions were things like tractor brigades and talking at county fairs and working in church basements with little education and letter writing sessions. And it worked pretty well in our state. One of the things I think is real important to mention is if you work close to home with people you know that area like the back of your hand. So you're much more likely to be successful with a local effort with people who can see each other face to face and have some local knowledge and resources than if you're working for something abstract and far away.
Now, Mary, my understanding is you have not won the war. There is a new route, so you won the battle, but it still comes through Nebraska, correct?
You have good information. That's absolutely right. And sometime between now and the fall, probably September, October, President Obama is expected to make a decision whether to approve this pipeline or not. Interesting, British Columbia has announced they will not allow a similar pipeline through their territory, that it wasn't safe. I don't know what President Obama will do, but I'll tell you something. Whatever he does, if he approves this pipeline, it's not over, because it's not over until the people in this state give up. And we aren't going to give up. There's too many of us, and we care too much about this. I was out at the State Department hearings in Grand Island, Nebraska. The State Department had one hearing on this entire pipeline, and they had it in our state because we've caused so much trouble back here. And it happened to be during an April blizzard, very bad blizzard, and the roads were closing all around us. We had to get out there real early in the morning. 1,000 people were out there. Over 800 of them were out there to testify against this pipeline. And they were old farmers who were standing out in the snow to reserve a place in line. Native Americans, we have a lot of reservation land in our state. A lot of Native Americans were there to say they will not let this pipeline cross their land. And it was really something to hear these people stand up that had driven, some of them, for hours through a blizzard to get there and say, we're not going to let this happen. It was really one of the times I was proudest of my state I've ever been.
And I think I would like to close with where you are now. You have not won yet. You don't know what's going to happen. How do you continue to keep going and to have hope? How do you not give up for anyone with any issue that they're concerned about?
Well, you know, here's what I've come to believe, Susan, that hope is not about outcome. Hope is in a hopeful process and doing something that you find meaningful and important. And so I'm a very process-oriented person. I don't know what'll happen with this pipeline. I don't know what'll happen with President Obama. For that matter, I don't know about the fate of the Earth. But I do know what happens to human beings when they decide to be agents of their own fate and organize with other people to try to protect themselves and their future. And something good happens when people do that.
Mary Pfeiffer, author of The Green Boat, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on. All my best wishes to you.
Mary Pfeiffer is the author of The Green Boat, Reviving Ourselves in Our Capsized Culture. And finally, a perfect example of a woman who refused to believe that she couldn't change the world. Gilles Malkin profiles Sojourner Truth.
Most of the people who hear this profile of an historical woman will be unable to identify with one of her earliest memories, which was to be sold as a slave, along with some livestock, at the age of 9. This remarkable woman was born in 1797 in the town of Esopus, Ulster County, New York, and was named Isabel Bomefree, later known as Sojourner Truth. Her parents were African, her father from Ghana and her mother from Guinea, both captured and brought to the United States as slaves and owned by the Hardenberg family. In 1827, New York became the first American state to abolish slavery, but it was Isabel Bomefree who made the most significant legal advance for African Americans. She took her former owner to court for having allowed the illegal sale of her son Peter. She received assistance from the Quakers and prevailed. Her son was returned to her. The case was the earliest instance of a black person winning a lawsuit against a white person. In 1850, she published a book titled The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, a Northern Slave, a memoir of her travels and travails in which she relates the fate of her parents and many others like them. One of the prime reasons for slaves being given their freedom was not because some magnanimous white owner believed that slavery was wrong, or that his slaves had served him faithfully and thus had earned their freedom, but simply that they were too old and infirm, and to keep them would represent a financial burden. Isabel was not free to care for her parents, who were expected in their old age now to fend for themselves thanks to their newfound freedom. After a debilitating life of hardship and abuse, they died destitute, in abject poverty and sickness. In 1829, she had a religious experience and vision and became a faithful Christian. Even so, it wasn't until 1843 that she changed her name to Sojourner Truth and began to preach for the abolition of slavery and women's rights. By all accounts, she had a true gift for it, and the effects of her talks were described in some cases as miraculous. For a time, she became an itinerant preacher, speaking and preaching in the churches of the day. Sojourner Truth's audiences varied widely in receptivity to what she had to say. In one instance, a heckler accused her of being a man. She opened her shirt and stared him down. At the Ohio Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio in 1851, Sojourner Truth delivered a speech which was to become the definitive statement of her career. There are conflicting accounts as to precisely what was said, but she did say that she could plant, plow, and bear the lash as well as any man, so why should he have rights that women don't? She countered the idea that men should have rights purely because Christ was a man, pointing out that he did not come from a man, but from the union of God and a woman. As she said, man had nothing to do with it. She said that she doubted if there can be anything more diametrically opposed to the religion of Jesus than the working of this soul-killing system of slavery, which is as truly sanctioned by the religion of America as are her ministers and churches. Devout as she was no fool. Sojourner Truth had a very personal, hand-forged understanding of the heart and basics of the Christian religion, and could impart it in such a way as to amaze people and make them believe that they'd been touched by the light. At one point, she met a crowd of people at a camp meeting who were greatly enamored of the idea of the Second Coming. The Adventists, as they were called, had generated great agitation among their flock with this notion of the cleansing fire upon the Lord's return. It was puzzling to Sojourner Truth that people should be so riled up about the possible reappearance of Christ, and she reminded them that they'd been given the task of maintaining the faith, not to rather entertain a delusion of being rescued from it. "I believe the Lord is as near as he can be," she replied to their inquiries. She told them that if indeed there would be a fire to burn the wicked, they had nothing to worry about, since Jesus would walk with them through the fire. Anyway, she believed, they were so distracted that, were the Lord to return that very day, he would most likely come and go completely unnoticed. Sojourner Truth lived close to the ground. She helped innumerable former slaves find housing and employment. She never learned to read, and she would not have understood why her likeness would someday grace a U.S. postage stamp. Although she met and spoke with both Lincoln and Grant, and earned the respect and admiration of Frederick Douglass, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and other luminaries, she was dirt poor all her life, as she never took wages for any work she did, which she regarded as her duty to do, as a decent human being. William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist newspaperman and social reformer, said that his acquaintance with Sojourner Truth led him to form a very high appreciation of her understanding, moral integrity, disinterested kindness, and religious sincerity and enlightenment. Sojourner Truth died on November 26, 1883, in Battle Creek, Michigan. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.